Well, on our JFK assassination night, one of our guests, Robert Morningstar, joined me. I was so riveted by the things he was talking about. I invited him back for a full program, which we're going to do tonight. And by the way, he's supplied some graphics, which I want you to go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at the crashed spacecraft on the moon. We're going to talk about that and some other issues, including, was the JFK assassination tied into UFO disclosure, and how did that change America? Robert Morningstar, my guest in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Morningstar, my guest, civilian intelligence analyst, psychotherapist in New York City, received a degree in psychology from Fordham University. He has studied the paranormal and UFOs for more than 40 years. He's published many research articles on the internet exposing government cover-up and deception and the JFK assassination, and his work is cited in many books on the assassination. Here he is back on Coast to Coast, Robert Morningstar. Robert, good morning, Morningstar. How are you?
Yes, sir. You're making me live up to my name.
I sure am. What's new with you?
Well, we have a lot. First of all, what's new with me is recovering from the marathon of radio interviews that I did up to past November 22nd, and one of the high points was being on with you that morning of the 23rd. I was very cognizant of the fact that you and I were speaking at the very moment 50 years later when President Kennedy's body was being doctored in the bad sense of the word, and rearranged, made up, photographed, fake photographs. A lot of terrible things were going on that night. I was cognizant of it. But I'm very grateful that we made it 50 years, George, and that the truth is bursting out and erupting, you might say, volcanically. Thousands of people, thousands of JFK researchers, UFO researchers, have worked together as a group, a team, and the sum total of the information that each individual has pulled out has given us a very clear picture of what happened on November 22nd. And I'm very grateful to be here again with you to talk about even more fascinating things, you know, like the relationship of the UFO issue to the assassination of the president.
Well, you know, Robert, we just touched the surface with you on the JFK night, and
yeah,
I had to get you back for a full show. I mean, I was getting emails. I'm still getting emails from people saying, bring him back, bring him back. And I respond, I am.
That's
so
right.
I'm glad you're here.
Thanks to the audience. You know, I'm not boasting, but I think that when I speak facts, and I present them to you and to the public as a matter of fact, that there is something that's called the ring of truth, and this ring of truth resonates with people. And I have to tell you, I received the most wonderful letter that I have ever received in my entire career in the JFK assassination field. And it was a thank you note from a lady in California who explained to me how listening to me give my views and expose the doctoring of the body of President Kennedy and the use of Officer Tippit's brain to as the getaway vehicle, you know, to present a brain that had been shot with one bullet through the head to the Warren Commission autopsist, pretending that it was President Kennedy's. And these poor, and I really say, I mean, poor guys, they were forced into this situation. Humes, Fink, and Boswell had never performed an autopsy in their lives, and they were recruited and told, you're going to do this, at the time when every major forensic pathologist was calling them up and offering their services. They chose three doctors at Bethesda who had never conducted an autopsy, and the criminal actions began right there, because I think that altering evidence in a murder case is one of the highest acts of criminality that anyone can conceive, because if you act in concert to protect killers of the President of the United States if you protect the criminals, you're a criminal yourself, you know. And
yeah.
Regardless of what defense they may have, oh, the threat of nuclear war, if we let the people know that communists and Castro were behind it, that was all hokum, you know, Lyndon Johnson hokum. And I'm glad that I've lived to see this day that the truth has finally emerged and people are hearing it. The lady wrote to me the most heartfelt letter I have ever read. Actually, I almost wept as I read it because I believe that we have been under a psychological attack. The nation has been under a great psychological attack since the day that happened. It was the first act of global terrorism because the death of President Kennedy was a shock to the soul of the whole world, the Western world, South America, everyone who knew of him. The only nation where it didn't even make a blink on the radar, as we say, was Red China because they just ignored it all. They didn't mention the thing at all. But this lady wrote to me that she was in seventh grade when JFK's assassination was announced. And she was traumatized because, like all of us or many of us, she loved President Kennedy. And then she said she went home and she heard Lee Harvey Oswald say, "No, sir, I didn't kill anybody." And she said that she could tell from his voice, as I did, that the man was telling the truth. There was no stress in his voice. You know, there's voice stress analysis now. Right. Well, we all have it to some degree, some more than others. And she and I both heard the innocence in Lee Harvey Oswald's voice. And then she says that she was totally shocked to see his murder on TV. Lee Harvey Oswald's murder was the first live murder ever transmitted on television. And that was a tremendous shock from which we're still not recovered. I said to Lisa Lyons earlier, how did the JFK assassination change America? It frightened and damaged the national psyche, causing mental disturbances, physical affliction in many people who lived through it to this day. And this lady wrote to me that when she heard me give my dissertation, basically on the mechanics of the JFK assassination cover-up, that she heard, she felt the truth of it, and she felt an elation, a happiness move through her body that released something in her. And she said, literally, "Something released in my lungs, and I was able to take the first full breath. I realized that I was able to take the first full breath in my life since that day in seventh grade." And this is my point, that the death and the cover-up of President Kennedy's death is an open wound in the national psyche. And only the truth and facing the truth about it can really heal that wound. We have people who live scared lives, and some are more scared than ever with the expansion of what I call a totalitarian scheme across the nation to take over every aspect of our lives. And they remain confused, and more are becoming unstable as a consequence of living the big lie of the Warren Commission report.
What percent, Robert, do you think of the people who were alive during Kennedy's assassination, you, me, what percent of them do you think are still alive? That number continues to go down, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I'm part of the baby boom generation, but a lot of the older folks, you know, have really gone away. I have no idea on the statistics of it, but those of us who remain were not fooled. We were cowed into silence. And actually, I do have a little bit of a grudge. It's not a grudge. I feel sorry for the people who were older than you and I, because I think we're about the same age, and we were in high school.
Yeah.
I was 15.
I was 13.
We had no power. We had no vote. We had no voice. But we really cared, and we watched intently, and we didn't go along with it. But the people who did have a voice, who did have a vote, who could have spoken out more strongly, they did not do so. And that generation is that generation that's perhaps 10 years older than we are now, and they are suffering the consequences of their silence.
You're right. Very few, Robert. We had Mark Lane, we had Garrison, but
right.
in terms of the American public generally, they were pretty silent. Now we had some talk radio shows going on during that mm-hmm. era, but people weren't as vocal as they are now. They simply took this tragedy and went home.
Well, I think a trick was used on us. Our patriotism was manipulated. We were told that, you know, for the sake of the country, the good of the nation, that we had to come together and support the usurper, yeah. Lyndon Johnson. And he used every trick, every ruse, and every lie that he could muster to intimidate, to cow, to goad submission from the Warren Commission. The submission of the Warren Commission is perfect. He browbeat every member to take the position. Earl Warren cried when he was told, "You're going to do this." Earl Warren, one of the greatest Supreme Court justices this country ever produced, is tainted. His whole his history is tainted by his association with this commission and its finding.
I had heard a tape of Johnson calling one of the senators, telling him, you know, "You're going to be on this committee." And he said, "No, I'm not." He says, "Sorry, I've already announced it to the media."
Yes. Yeah. Well, Johnson was the person, he was really a bully. There are times, I mean, it is described that he would take people and just shake them and kick them in the shins to make them submit. Jeez. He was a sociopath of the first order. And I have no qualms about saying that because, honestly, Lyndon Johnson killed 58,000 of my generation in Vietnam. And I don't have any way of justifying that crime.
When he could have said no to those generals and the military-industrial complex, but he just went around with it.
No, he said yes to save his neck because on November 22nd, 1963, at about 2 in the afternoon, the Senate committee that had been reviewing his corruption was going to come out with its vote on whether or not to proceed with impeachment.
And was that Billy Saul Estes case? Was
Billy Saul Estes and Bobby Baker. These are the two major corruption crimes that were exposed. Bobby Baker was his executive secretary, and he was going around picking up bribes, cash, and shopping bags and taking them back to Johnson. He was found out. And Billy Saul Estes, who, as I understand, is still alive, wrote a book about it. Billy Saul Estes was a friend of Lyndon Johnson, and Johnson knew that a certain patch of federal lands was a site where a lot of development was planned, you know, superhighways and development of centers and towns and things like that. Like laying down a railroad line in the 1880s, you know? We have vast lands out west. But those places where that railroad was going to run were going to be worth millions. And it's the same in Texas with this project. So Johnson found out that this was going to happen. It's insider trading, we would call it today. And so he tipped off Billy Saul Estes that he could buy these acres, hundreds of thousands of acres, for pennies on the dollar. And that within a year, year and a half, when these public work projects were announced, he would sell them for $100 an acre.
Wow.
So this was found out by a U.S. Marshal of the Department of Agriculture, whose name was Henry Marshall. And he began this investigation, and he was getting to the truth. And he was murdered and I know who murdered him. I knew Madeline Brown, Lyndon Johnson's mistress for many, many years, who wrote a book called Texas in the Morning. And I spoke to her for hours and hours in 1996 and 97. She sent me an original manuscript of her book, which was then edited and then published. But she told me on the phone, Henry Marshall was killed by Malcolm Wallace. And Malcolm Wallace was a retainer of Lyndon Johnson, whom he would call whenever he needed somebody murdered. Jeez. Lyndon Johnson had at least 8 murders to his credit as he rose to the presidency of the United States. And Henry Marshall was killed with 3 bullets to the stomach in his own garage.
No motive, no nothing.
Suicide. Controlled Texas so thoroughly that he was able to force an autopsy report that said that this man had put 3 rifle bullets in his own stomach in his own garage.
Rifle bullets?
Yeah, it was rifle bullets. It wasn't a pistol to the head or a pistol to the heart like that poor Admiral Bourse during the Clinton administration. That's another fishy death.
Well, but I guess where you're coming here, Robert, is we lost something on that day, and we have still never gotten it back, have we?
Not completely, not until we have the whole truth. And I don't know why we continue to speak about the Warren Commission report as the authoritative government investigation when the House Select Committee investigation was more thorough than they were.
It was. And concluded there was a conspiracy.
Conclusion that it was probably a conspiracy and one involving organized crime.
That's right.
And that has now become very clear that the organized crime that they were talking about was that arm of organized crime that had been working with the CIA in planning the assassination of Fidel Castro.
Isn't it amazing that Castro has outlived all of them?
Amazing.
He's there. I mean,
It is. It is. Keeping your head low and not leaving Cuba, I guess, helped. But
that did help.
It's really amazing. He has survived them all. He survived Khrushchev, Kennedy, Johnson.
Everybody.
Everybody. And who knows? He may be even listening to you tonight.
Yeah, he may be.
Castro speaks English. He went to school in America for a while, and he was originally, when he became president of Cuba, then premier, when he changed stripes, he was hoping that America would support him. But when there was a sugar crisis, you see, and they wanted to give him a lowball price on sugar.
Right.
And he didn't like kowtowing to American corporate interests.
That's when he started to nationalize, right?
I'm just talking about the sugar deal. They refused to pay him what he was asking for sugar. And so he said, hell with you guys, you know, I'm going to sell the sugar to Russia. And Castro made a deal with Khrushchev to buy Cuban sugar. Now, I remember when that happened. And the really, it was a national crisis in America because even then, America was addicted to sugar. And Cuban sugar was the sweetest sugar you could get. So then, of course, there was a sugar shortage. And all of the companies started going bonkers because they couldn't get that raw sugar cane from Cuba. And they had to resort to squeezing sugar out of other vegetables like carrots.
The price must have zoomed.
Huh? And when the sugar bags started to come out, you know, 3 months, 4 months, 6 months later, in the old days, we'd take half a spoon of sugar and put in a cup of coffee, and that was as sweet as you needed it. And then when these new bags of sugar derived from carrots came out, you'd take one. And it's like, ugh.
Hold on. We're gonna take this break, talk a little bit more about that. Then I want to get into JFK and these UFOs next. Hey, take a free look as much as you want of our television show, Beyond Belief. As a matter of fact, you can look at all the old past programs, and do please watch the program I did with the late Lloyd Pye. We just received word yesterday that he had passed on, and of course, you know, he was pushing hard to find out the origin of the Star Child Project. And you can look at that program absolutely free. just simply go to www.beyondbelief.com and sign up for the information and look at as many programs as you want. Back in a moment with Robert Morningstar on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Robert Morningstar with us. Robert, the JFK assassination and UFOs, you touched on that a little bit during our JFK special.
Yes.
In a relationship with Nikita Khrushchev as well. Let's go back. Would you give us a review on that story?
Okay. One of the main problems that was occupying President Kennedy's mind was the risk of accidental nuclear war as a result of mistaking UFOs that would come in over the North Pole and be picked up by the Bemuse and the Dew Line. Bemuse was ballistic missile early warning line, and then the Dew Line was a more advanced version of that. And what we found out was that UFOs had the capacity to mimic the characteristics of ICBMs, and they would probe our airspace and intrude in such a way as to make a NORAD think that the Russians had launched a nuclear warhead at the United States. As we went into a nuclear defensive alert, the UFO, which later became codenamed Fast Walkers, would stop dead in its tracks, change direction, and zip off to disappear and off the radar screen and actually into outer space. And so this was a great concern because the same thing was being done to the Russians, as if this third party was playing us off against each other and playing a cat and mouse game with both of us in the hope that we would annihilate each other. That's the only conclusion that I can come to.
Dangerous cat and mouse game, no doubt.
Yes.
Huh?
Divide and conquer, you might call it, but and perhaps that was it. That is the reason that they're here, divide and conquer, to keep us away from national unity and obstructing communications. President Kennedy found obstruction of communications to be inherent in the bureaucracy that had been established, the protocols of the State Department, the Pentagon, Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Central Intelligence Agency. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy had a harrowing experience. He came so close to nuclear war that he no longer trusted his advisors. He had the hotline put in to the White House to connect him directly to Moscow because communications took 24 hours from Washington to Khrushchev.
Mm-hmm.
Message would go from Kennedy to the embassy in Washington. They had to encode the message. Then they had to transmit it to Russia. It had to be decoded, and then it had to be typed and then taken to Khrushchev. That process took about 24 hours because there was no internet. And the Russians had their secret communication systems by which they transferred these messages. So 24 hours was much too long. And one of the great miscalculations that President Kennedy and McNamara and the Joint Chiefs made was they believed that that Khrushchev ultimately held the reins on nuclear weapons, that the stovepipe type of hierarchy in the Soviet Union was a one-way, one leader, one man commands everything type of setup. But Khrushchev, people forget, Khrushchev is the man who defeated Nazi Germany at Stalingrad. He was the commissar of Stalingrad during the siege, and it was he who led the Russian forces took General Paulus, Field Marshal Paulus' army, and captured it. And that sounded the death knell in 1943 of Germany as a war power, a war-making nation. They had lost their entire Russian army to the forces of Khrushchev. Now, Khrushchev was a very wily fellow. And when this thing blew up, heated up, the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was well aware that it would take 24 hours to get the messages from Moscow to his field commanders in Cuba. So, and he said, if they hit us first, and our system is this way that I'm the only man in charge of the nuclear missiles, we're goners. So he sent a message in the early days of the Cuban Missile Crisis to his field commander in Cuba, where they did have tactical nuclear missiles already on launchers. And he told him, if you see the 7th Fleet appear off Cuba, and if you see a landing of American troops on Cuba, you can use the Luna missiles on your own initiative. And McNamara and Kennedy and the Joint Chiefs of Staff did not know this. And they were planning precisely that. The other thing that happened, which is very interesting because there's an analogy in modern times with Obama's red line in Syria.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
If they use chemical weapons, that'll be it. And then he tried to engage us in a Syrian war. And I thank the people of England, the British Parliament, for having stopped that in its tracks. And to my knowledge, this is the first time that the people of the world, we now had an avenue for self-expression that we didn't have in 1963. I think if there had been an internet in 1963, Lyndon Johnson would not have survived a month. If the people of the United States had had internet and telecommunications assets that we have today, Lyndon Johnson would have fallen in 1 month. He would have been exposed completely.
They would have ousted him. He would have been impeached.
Immediately. But he was able to control information so adeptly, so well, that everyone was cowed into silence. And anyone who might speak up would be charged with being unpatriotic.
That's,
and the same trick was used on us for the passage of the Patriot Act. What a misnomer, you know?
That's right. Well, and he had J. Edgar Hoover to do some of his dirty work, didn't he?
J. Edgar Hoover was his bosom buddy who lived right across the street from him all those years in Washington. They were next-door neighbors. And J. Edgar Hoover had a great hatred of John F. Kennedy as well for many reasons. He knew all about Kennedy's sexual exploits.
Yes.
And he considered him immoral. And he blackmailed him, actually. Kennedy wanted Hoover to resign. And Hoover went to visit him and pulled out his dossier on Kennedy and his trysts.
Probably laid it right out on the desk.
Right out of the desk, and showed him that he knew that during World War II, he was dating a Danish, a very beautiful Danish girl, who was a Nazi. And even in 1960, here's another one. Even in 1961, Kennedy had an affair with the wife of an East German diplomat. And that came to Hoover's attention. And he used that as well to blackmail Kennedy into leaving him in office.
Why didn't Hoover use it, you know, when Kennedy was running against Nixon, to simply tell him, you know what, get out? Bow out, or did he decide just to?
Well, I don't think that Hoover or anybody else expected Kennedy to win. That's the fact. Everyone expected that Nixon would win, and as a result of the mafia's assistance, which was bought by Joe Kennedy in buying the support of Sam Giancana, the mafia boss of Chicago.
Yep. The same mob that then turned against Kennedy in '63, right?
Well, here's the key that I've just discovered. The real target of the revenge of the mafia, as explicitly stated by Sam Giancana's grandson, was to get even with Joe Kennedy. because they felt that Joe Kennedy had double-crossed them, not John F. Kennedy. Joseph P. Kennedy had approached Giancana and said, listen, my boys will take care of you. Help my son get elected president of the United States, and, you know, he'll go easy on you. He didn't tell that to Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, but he told it to Sam Giancana. And when the Kennedy brothers turned on organized crime, they felt betrayed not by Jack Kennedy, but by their father.
And so that was the administration's entire push during those 3 years. Organized crime, the Teamsters, that's what they wanted.
Well, exactly so. But you know what? We have this term that we've heard before called invisible government.
Yeah.
The invisible government. And it's now associated with a permanent bureaucracy that is in Washington. And by that I mean presidents get elected, come into office, leave office, new presidents and their retinue, their staffs, their appointees come into office. But there is a certain group of individuals in government, in the State Department, in the Pentagon, who stay there year in, year out, no matter what administration is in power. And now that people think about that as the invisible government. But I found the original source of that phrase, the invisible government, and it was in 1958 that the New York Times published an editorial exposing what they called the invisible government. And their definition of the invisible government was organized crime. Organized crime had its hand in every business. Organized crime collected taxes, which we call extortion, protection money. And the New York Times labeled them the invisible government. And so when the mafia made the deal with the CIA, or I should say the other way around, the CIA made the deal with the mafia because it was their initiative to reach out to the mafia to try to get rid of Castro. That group, that invisible government, attached itself to our visible government and became partners in crime. And the ultimate crime was the killing of President Kennedy to hush up the UFO issue, which he wanted to expose to the American public in 1964 after his election, and to ensure that we would go into Vietnam and conduct a war that would be beneficial to the military-industrial complex.
This UFO issue with Kennedy, how much did Kennedy know? I mean, was it just, you know, the flybys and the, you know, the havoc it was, the UFOs were
Kennedy lived the whole UFO era from beginning to the end of his life. And the IPU, the Interplanetary Phenomenon unit that recovered the Roswell crash, made a report, and in one of the items, I believe it's item 11, it said that we have become aware that Congressman John F. Kennedy has learned of this incident, that he was briefed on a flight from Boston to Washington by a member of the staff of the Secretary of the Air Force. And he should, basically, they're saying he should be watched. This was Army counterintelligence. So he was on a watch list as one of the people who had learned of it outside official channels. It's interesting to note that this Secretary of the Air Force that they were referring to was Stuart Symington, the uncle of Fife Symington, the governor of Arizona, at the time, was governor at the time that
the Phoenix Lights
happened. So there is a kind of family tradition involved here between the people who want it known and the families that want it to remain unknown. I have here before me the first report of the MJ-12, the Majestic 12 Committee.
And let's go back, review for us, for some people who don't know what that committee was.
Okay. Well, when the Roswell crash occurred, and two craft were recovered, one almost intact, damaged, crashed into a hillside, and the other one in pieces scattered all over the Brazos farm, Brazel's Ranch. The team, the recovery team, went in there and picked up the pieces, then made a report, and this was submitted to Washington. Washington organized another committee called the Majestic 12 Committee, and empowered it to do an assessment of what the implications of this find were. And so they attacked the problem on many levels and issued a report that basically covered these things. First was the nature of the investigation. Second, the panel's contribution to the top secret Majestic Research and Intelligence Program. The third was a review of the military assessment with the select comments for conclusions of the JIC and IAC members. Then there was the problem relative to technology, problems in relation to nuclear weapons development, problems in relation to biological warfare programs, problems in relation to genetics and pharmaceutical development programs, mm-hmm. problems in relation to new materials development, problems in relation to planned future rocket development programs, problems in relation to nuclear propulsion development programs, problems in relation to intelligence gathering and analysis, relations to foreign policy and national security, relation to domestic and constitutional issues, relations to social, religious, and scientific reactions, relations to Cold War development, in relation to the government policy of control and denial. Furthermore, the conclusions, the current studies of otherworld visitation are in three phases: technology exploitation, interplanetary travel, and cultural communications. So you see the list is a lot of problems.
It's huge.
Because this find involved a complete revision of everything that science had believed until July 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 1947. We were no longer alone in the universe. All of those legends and stories, myths, you know, of spooks, goblins, things that go bump in the night, all of a sudden, they were no longer myths. These things do go bump in the night. The creatures that operate the UFO had the capacity to appear in the blink of an eye and disappear in the blink of an eye, in a flash. They learned that UFOs are not craft that are like our aircraft. They do not penetrate the atmosphere the way our aircraft do. The Air Force came to believe that they were actually time machines, that they blink in and blink out, mm-hmm. and that our eyes, in a sense, connect the blinks in a line, because that's how we assume things move in our material universe, but they are operating on a different technology. There's quite a good book on what the Air Force came to believe, two good books on what the Army and the Air Force came to believe. One is the Roswell book by Philip Corso, The Day After Roswell. And a more technical one by Robert Collins, Exempt from Disclosure, which revealed a lot of the more technical aspects of the propulsion systems and the physics involved in UFO propulsion, which is anti-gravitic, electromagnetogravitics. They bend space, they warp space-time, and they don't move like our jets do. They're not based on any technology like that. And so exploitation of technology, I mentioned that, the conclusions, you see they listed all those problems, but when it came to the conclusions, it dealt with exploitation of the technology, interplanetary travel, that means us getting off.
Let's talk some more about MJ-12, Robert, when we come back, and I want to get into the Apollo missions as well. Robert Morningstar, our guest, right here on Coast to Coast AM.